This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling. Recently, a close friend of mine experienced an unexpected loss. Watching their family struggle emotionally and financially made me stop and think seriously about my own family's future. As the primary provider, I know how important it is to make sure that if anything ever happened to me, my family would still be able to manage. So I realized that without life insurance, my family would be left with overwhelming financial burdens. I looked into coverage before, but the process always felt complicated, got endless forms, phone calls, and medical exams, made everything take weeks. So that's why Ethos stood out to me. Their process is simple and 100% online. There's no medical exam required, just a few health questions, and you get a quote in as little as 10 minutes. In many cases, you can even receive same-day coverage without ever leaving your house. Ethos offers up to $3 million in coverage, with some policies starting as low as $2 a day, billed monthly. It's a trustworthy company that's changing the way people think about life insurance. So protect your family's financial future with life insurance from Ethos. Get your free quote at ethos.com/Brian. That's ethos.com/Brian. Application times may vary. Rates may vary.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here. The weekend is through, and what a bloody weekend we had. Steph Kite's going to be with us. She's from Axios. We're going to go inside the healthcare push. We're also going to talk about what President Trump said over the weekend, that told the Wall Street Journal he's not sure he can win the midterms. He knows historically it's going to be tough, and he's going to wait for his economic programs to really kick in, which would be first or definitely the second quarter. You do that, the economy starts rolling. I think he's going to have a lot of success. Lawrence Jones is also in studio, which is fresh off Fox and Friends. And before we get to Lawrence, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
I absolutely support President Trump's strategy, and we, the Venezuelan people, are very grateful because I believe he is a champion of freedom in this hemisphere.
And Face the Nation didn't want to hear that. Maria Corina Machado praising President Trump and his Venezuelan policies, amping up the intensity in Venezuela as the would-be next leader salutes Trump and reveals her game plan for taking over the country after winning the election. Trump and Rubio have plans to tighten the squeeze on Maduro. I'll go over it.
Number two.
So you've got abundant energy, you've got falling rents, that will push inflation lower, and the president's right. This inflation has been embedded because of 4 years of very pro-inflation, anti-living standards policy.
Yep, that's Joe Livorno, the counselor to the Secretary of Treasury. All agree with the midterms are about the economy. We are not stupid. We look at the Trump game plan and look at the stats as we start the spring to the midterms.
Number one.
There was a plethora of warning signs ever since the massacre that occurred on October 7, 2023. The Australian Jewish community, like many other diaspora Jewish communities in the West, have been under a violent and increasingly siege mentality.
Yes, that's Jolie Burney of the of Australia. Bloody brutal weekend. We see two American soldiers killed in Syria, 15 Jews murdered by Islamic extremists in Australia, and we also see a mind-numbing mass shooting at the campus of Brown University, and we're still looking for a suspect. So, Lawrence, we've been doing this all morning because these are three very different attacks. We're still trying to find out about Brown because there were a lot of Jewish kids in that class. We wonder if that has anything to do with it. But as we try to piece this together, let's start with Brown.
Well, they got themselves in a pickle as it relates to the investigation, because anytime you get someone in custody, or they at least announce that you're in custody, and then you release the guy and say that this was the person that was a person of interest, that doesn't look good for the investigation. Then we find out at 11 p.m. At night that that they've released them. So there's no, it doesn't look like there's any real video surveillance. I do wonder, Brian, there's a guy that says, I came face-to-face with him. You would think there's a sketch artist or something. Even Luigi Mangione, who had a mask on, they were able to get a description on him. So that's important.
So we get this eyewitness on camera. ABC gets this eyewitness on camera. And I'm wondering, did he go to the cops?
Right.
Because the cops, really, if you want an eyewitness, as I looked him eye to eye and he had a big gun. Really? I thought it was a handgun.
Right.
How big is this gun? Is it big because I've never seen a gun before? Is it big for a pistol? Or is it big for a rifle? So overall, the big picture is the threat environment is up. Pierre Thomas of ABC, the chief justice correspondent, said this, according to intelligence sources he has. Cut 20.
Unfortunately, I don't have a lot of good news. The FBI recently put out a bulletin warning that the holidays right now, this season we're in, is especially a dangerous period of time. We've seen since the beginning of the year, the New Year's Day attack in New Orleans. Also, around Halloween, the FBI said they uncovered a plot targeting Michigan. And just the day before Thanksgiving, we had those National Guardsmen here shot, one killed. So it's a dangerous season, and this threat environment is as dangerous as we've seen before 9/11.
So the threat level is high for two reasons. Number one is it's the holiday season and people are joyous and their head is not really on the swivel that it normally is doing, you know, day to life. Number two is it's the holidays. You got a Christian holiday and then you also have a Jewish holiday as well. Well, radical Islamists don't like those holidays. They don't agree with them and they want death. So
I think we got to disseminate, and you can do this. You do this all the time. Salafist Muslims.
Right.
They are the extremists. That's Bin Laden.
Correct.
Now, they're everyday Muslims. For example, as we push over to Australia, we see two gummies, a father and son, father in his 50s, son 20-something, one on a bridge, one down by the park, just shooting as many Jewish members of their congregation they can at a Hanukkah celebration. The guy that jumped the dad, the 50-year-old, and took the rifle away and maybe saved two dozen lives is also Muslim, and he's from Syria.
Right.
And he said, I'm going to put my lives on the line. He reaches over, says to his cousin, tell my kids that I died a hero. He expects to die.
Right.
He jumps and grabs his gun away from a guy like you could only hope you would during those times. Selfless. He sells fruit, and he was selling fruit to the Hanukkah.
And got shot twice.
Yeah, by the Jewish people as they were walking down. He goes, you know, I could go down there and sell my fruit, but I'm just going to sell it at the top at the park. And ironically, I was there 2 years ago because my daughter studied for a semester in Sydney. Mm-hmm. So I know exactly Bondi Park and know exactly the area. Beautiful, by the way, summer. So he goes by, he tackles him. This guy ends up taking the gun, not shooting the guy. But then the son turns around and shoots him twice.
Yeah, he was
going to survive.
But it's a tragedy in the sense of, you know, obviously you got 15 people are dead. You got even more that are critically injured. And you're right, Brian. There's a lot of peaceful Muslims out there that live their dead. But the handful of them that are out here causing hell, it's a lot. That handful is a lot. And they're going for maximum impact. And I just think that after October the 7th, the radical elements were able to come out of the shadows, and they were able to do that in the guise of protests and the guise of saying, I'm fighting for the kids in Gaza. And that wasn't true because they were still saying, eliminate a whole group of people. So I think we got our heads off a swivel because we wanted to be politically correct and say, okay, we stand with the kids and we're just going to allow them to protest. Meanwhile, they're saying, exterminate a whole group of people.
Right. Yeah, they are. And how is it that they're so organized after the horrific attacks on Israelis in Gaza, over 1,200 dead, hundreds of captured, taken hostage, and brutalized. You see this horrific, and they're protesting against Israel. Really?
Right.
Excuse me. That's a script. 100%. Those are checks. These people are getting paid. So Senator Lindsey Graham says, wake up, America. Cut 22.
I want to attack ISIS training camps, wherever they may be. And what I want to know about Syria, was this gunman associated with the Syrian security forces? Was this a green-on-blue attack? Was this an attack of somebody inside the Syrian security forces that turned on us? Or was it just a lone gunman associated with ISIS?
No.
That's an important distinction. I want to know about that.
Right. So they're saying no.
Yeah, they're saying no. And I mean, it's important to know back, I guess, 10, 15 years ago, those attacks were common, where you would get someone, you welcome in, they were an interpreter or something like that, or they were an asset, and they turned on you. It looks like from the president as well as the president of Syria, they're saying that wasn't the case here. So that is some I'll say, and Brian, you know this better than anyone. I know people are critical of the president with his relationship with the Syrian president.
How sure are.
But it is a complicated situation when you're dealing with that part of the region. I'm not saying I agree with everything that guy stands for, but if you want to combat the terrorists, the real threat, the ISIS-inspired terrorists, if you want to conquer Al-Qaeda and all of those radical groups, you need people from the inside.
Absolutely. And the thing is, he was Al-Qaeda. He said enough things that makes the other Sunni Gulf states in the region believe that they're looking to turn the page. Guy got rid of Assad, who is in control of the Alawites, which is a small Shia sect. He's now living his life in hopefully in horror in Russia. But this guy al-Shaar is worth the risk. And this is the other thing, Lawrence. The reason why that peace deal was able to come together at all is because won over the Gulf states. They said, listen, the head of the UAE, the MBS over at Saudi Arabia, go, look, Syrian president really wants to give it a shot. I'd love for you to meet with him. Yeah. He goes, send him over. And they met with him. So he said, you trusted us.
Right.
Now I'm going to trust you. I'm going to sign on to this peace deal.
That's exactly right.
So even though he's not perfect, and we're not looking for a democracy necessarily in Syria, we're just looking for these religious sects to be protected and maybe not to be Assad.
Yeah.
And to be anti-Iran is certainly a plus.
Well, and to that point, and we want them to eventually get to anti-Russia as well, because there's still a partnership right there as well that, I'm not too happy about. But, Brian, I'll say this. It's hard to manage that region. And look, you're not going to get rid of all the radical elements because it's in their religious doctrine. So some aspects of it, you're not going to, we just don't want them to kill our people.
Yeah.
So that's the one thing. Some, you know, we want to police the world in the sense of, you know, we want them to treat women respectfully and all that. But sometimes in that part of the region, you're not going to get that. So, you know this better than anyone.
So before we go, the one thing we have talked about this all morning, so let's do something a little different. Let's talk a little about the economy. Were you surprised the president said to the Wall Street Journal, hey, look, I don't know how we're going to do in the midterms. Historically, there's only been twice in 100 years where a sitting president who wins an election in the midterm election ends up with more seats. Mm-hmm. It was Bill Clinton after winning in 96. He was very strong in 98.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was George W. Bush after 9/11 attacks. His approval rating was 72%. Mm-hmm. And he ends up holding on and gaining some seats. And then everything, you know, and he won re-election, but lost, I think, a chamber of the House. And then ultimately, he would not end popular with about 32% approval rating. For Donald Trump, he's saying, look, I am not sure what's going to happen. Are you surprised to hear him say that?
I got two things. Number one, I think the president is turning the temperature down. And he's setting the expectations low right now when it comes to midterms. So he's not going to get – he wants – He has to drive people to the polls. So There has to be some risk. So he's conceded on that point. Number two, we saw something different from the president last week. He changed the way he was tackling the affordability crisis. He goes, look, maybe I shouldn't call it a hoax because you guys are going to, you know, misinterpret what I'm saying. But there is a problem right there. But I'm not responsible for that. And, Brian, he's back on the road again, which is – that is him and his element. He's bringing people on stage, talking about how the tax cuts are going to benefit them, telling them to file for the income taxes early in January because that's when they're going to see more of their money.
So right now NBC says, satisfied with your health care plan, I saw that 82% very or somewhat satisfied with the health care plan. I thought this was interesting. 18% dissatisfied, almost the same year to year. But now with the ACA premium subsidies there for the pandemic only, most people, the 24 million, could see their subsidies go up 114%. But Senator Bill Cassidy says, well, you guys are missing the point. What's the sense of telling people who live paycheck to paycheck that your subsidies are going away? You think, yeah, that might be problematic. But you know what's worse? A $6,000 deductible.
Right.
Your 8-year-old sprains his ankle. Your wife needs treatment for something. That doesn't hit $6,000 threshold. Right. So you're still writing all these checks. He goes, why can't I get you, take some of that money, and get it to people to pay for their health care if you're not going to touch your deductible with Obamacare? How do you feel about this surgical approach to it?
I think Cassidy is trying. I want to be optimistic on this. It is. Look, I actually sent you that piece, Brian. Every single time, whether Republicans put a plan up or they don't put a plan up, they always lose when it comes to
healthcare.
Every single time. Like this is a prime example. Democrats wanted Obamacare. They have put so much money into Obamacare. Everybody knows that the cost of healthcare is going up. And Republic, you guys said that this was going to fix all the problems. So why are we still talking about it?
Right.
And Republicans still get the blame when it comes to health care.
Yeah, so they're going to try to do something maybe before the break, although I think Schumer wants it as something to run on. Here's Bill Cassidy. This is Cut 29.
We've got to do something for affordability for the people in the exchanges. And I will say that the only thing the Democrats would accept was something that would decrease the premiums. But if a family has a $6,000 out-of-pocket before they get into the strength of the insurance plan, then frankly, the policy is catastrophic. It brings profit to the insurance company, but not benefit to the patient.
So here's, he went on to say this, cut 30.
I would argue that it actually is, there has to be a meeting of the minds between Democrats and Republicans. Let's acknowledge you've got to put cash in the patient's pocket to pay the out-of-pocket. I would be willing to do a short-term extension of the premium tax credits for those people with higher premiums if they will concede that we've got to do something for the $6,000 out-of-pocket. I think there's a deal to be had here. We need to push for that deal.
Such a landmine, such a landmine. Brian, I may be, I consider myself out of the bubble, right? So I think I talked to a good sample of Americans. They do talk about affordability. But I don't hear the majority of the people that I'm talking to saying when they're talking about affordability that they're talking about healthcare. I just don't hear that. I hear about groceries. I hear about their energy prices. I hear about they want more pay from their job and all that. I don't hear healthcare being the main concern. And so I'm not sure. Look, I'm not saying obviously there's polling samples that say it's a major issue for people. I just don't think it is worth the political minefield that it is to tackle it in this way. But I could be in the minority.
Do you think that something's going to get done before Christmas?
I don't think. I think it's way too quick. I think it's way too quick. And it's so complicated. There's so many. I think the president's best bet is to go with the idea of giving the money directly to the people. The hybrid approach is some are calling
it. And the thing is, on the surface, we don't talk enough Democrats, but by the way, as a Democrat, are you pro-insurance company? Most would say no. So then set up the healthcare accounts and take the same money. You can declare victory, whatever you want to do, and then give people control of their own healthcare. That would be the beginning of a Republican.
I think some of them worry that some people won't use that money for the healthcare.
Well, they'll put restrictions on it, hopefully. I mean, the restrictions.
I mean, the president essentially said, you know, it's your money. So if you want to use it for healthcare, great. If you don't want to use it for healthcare, great as well.
They would never sign up to that in Congress. So, yeah, I guess we'll see what happens. And of course, before I let you go, Rob Reiner, it looks like one of his kids.
A lot of reports are suggesting.
That's what everyone's suggesting. I'm reading the front headlines in the LA Times just talks about Rob Reiner's career.
Right.
Two people were brutally murdered in their home. Famous people. I mean, that's with a knife, stabbed to death.
Brutally. Brian, I've been kind of disappointed in the way they've been handled in this. I mean, you don't want to confirm that it's even their identity and the family has already put out a statement? Come on.
Lawrence Jones will watch tonight on Hannity. Yep. Back tomorrow on Fox and Friends. Different outfit, right?
Different outfit. Yep. I should shower, right?
If you want.
Right.
It's totally optional. There's no necessity.
Maybe today.
Every day. America's first responders stand ready. Firefighters, law enforcement, paramedics, doctors, dispatchers, and people who put themselves on the line for public safety. But keeping them connected in moments of crisis has not been easy. That's why Congress authorized a nationwide network for public safety. Today, that promise is fulfilled through FirstNet. It's the only nationwide network built with and for first responders. So whether it's a big city, rural town, or remote tribal community, FirstNet helps ensure no call for help goes unanswered. It gives first responders priority access, never throttles their communications in the U.S., helping them to connect across agencies when it matters most. This isn't just a network. It's a lifeline, a bipartisan commitment to America's public safety built to serve those who serve us all. FirstNet is the backbone of our nation's emergency response and will continue to be in the future. FirstNet, built with AT&T. Learn more on firstnet.com/public safety first.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
So Ukraine over the weekend, yesterday, Zelensky did what he's supposed to do. He goes to Berlin, he's working on some deals, and they're talking about the Donbass. He still keeps 32% of it. I love that he went to the front lines and showed everybody that Russia is lying to you. They're not making progress on the front lines. He actually stood within 10 miles of Russia. Ukraine's long-range missile campaign continues to degrade Russia's oil refineries and military capabilities. The Ukrainian forces recently advanced in two different cities. I think that's important. Russian forces will likely continue to struggle to maintain what the Kremlin's desire, multi-pronged offensive operations. They moved over to Odessa. Okay. Oh, they'll meet you in Odessa. You tried to take Odessa multiple times. It has not worked. I don't know why you think you're going to get it now. Now you're going to see Ukraine sign off on a 20-point plan. And you're going to see Russia go, yeah, I'm not signing on that. And Mr. President, after that happens, do not sign off on Ukraine. Just say, guys, here are your Patriots. Here are your Tomahawks. Let me know when they want to talk. And that's what Ukraine really prefers. I love the fact that the U.S. and Ukraine is targeting the 1,000-vessel dark fleet smuggling sanctioned oil worldwide. That would be great. They're rickety, they're rusty, and they go to all our enemies for discounted rates. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Steph Kite next. Real American Freestyle is the first ever unscripted pro wrestling league created by Hulk Hogan, Chad Bronstein, Israel Martinez, and Eric Bischoff to give elite wrestlers a real shot at professional career. Real American Freestyle is where Olympians, world champions, and NCAA legends come to compete. Not in a cage, not in a script, but on the mat in front of fans around the world. This is real wrestling, reimagined for today. The first event kicks off August 30th in Cleveland, featuring matchups with some of the best wrestlers on the planet. You've never seen wrestling like this. Learn more at realamericanfreestyle.com.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So Republicans have a policy imperative to put forward something, and the president's the guy who can do this, ultimately put forward a plan that can address these challenges. Politically, if he does not address this, the challenge, of course, is that the party in power traditionally loses about 30 seats in the House in a midterm election. You look back over the last five cycles. Politically, it is going to come back and bite Republicans if they're not able to make some progress on this critical issue.
I mean, it's better for the country. The president, all he could do is, economically, is control. What do you control? Well, put his policies in place. He believes they're going to be effective and let the chips fall where they may. And that's pretty much what he said over the weekend in the Wall Street Journal. We know since World War II, only two presidents saw their party gain House seats in the midterm. Bill Clinton in 98, George W. Bush in 2002. Even with having said that, you could have a very successful presidency and still face losing a chamber. So far, the president's got 42% approval, according to NBC's poll. That's just one. 70% approve of Trump in the MAGA world. I think that's a little bit lower than I'm used to seeing, down about 8 since April. But that's what happens. You make decisions. I mean, you make decisions that traditional Republicans go, wow, what a relief. He's more traditional. MAGA gets upset. You know, they might, MAGA world gets upset that we took out the nuclear power program, the nuclear weapons program of Iran. Can you believe that? You have the MAGA Republicans, some of them getting upset, or the podcast world. And then have others saying that's exactly what you should have been doing. Thank goodness for taking action. So when you do that, somebody's not going to be happy. But it doesn't mean you're not doing the right thing. This is another interesting thing before we go to our guest. Personal finance. NBC did a poll. Are you better or the same as you were a year ago? Or are you in a good place? Are you better or the same personally? 65%, 66 last April said they're in a good place, the same or better. This year, 65%. So wait a second. So everybody is so unhappy in one poll with the economy, but at the same time, when asked about your personal finance situation, it's basically a dead heat from last time. 35% said they're worse. Steph Kite joins us now from Axios. Steph, are you surprised the president told the Wall Street Journal, hey, I'm not sure what's going to happen on the midterms? He usually likes to take the opposite tact.
Yeah, I mean, I think it shows that he is at least a little bit nervous. He understands that historically, you know, coming after Republicans had a big year last year, when you go into the next midterm cycle, historically, it's a little bit tougher for Republicans. And as, I mean, Axios has reported and others have as well, that Trump and his advisors are very confident that the economy is going to, you know, really kick off strong in 2026. They're hoping that that helps their chances. But there is still a sentiment in the U.S. that the economy hasn't gotten but so much better for them. And it's an issue that Democrats are clearly pouncing on. And it's an issue that, of course, Republicans used just last year. Right. And it was very effective.
But Steph, the thing that is so interesting is that if you ask the president how he's going to make the country more affordable, he'll go, okay, here's what I'm doing energy. This is what I'm doing on regulation. This is what I'm doing with tariffs. This is what I did with the big, beautiful bill. This is with tax. I mean, whatever you want. You might not like all 10 items off the top of my head, but you could say, that's my plan. Let's hope it works. If I say to Democrats, or affordability, yes, affordability is a problem. What do you want to do? raise taxes back to 39% from 37.5%? I don't know. Like, what is the, not that they need it because they're not in power, but it would help if they said, this is the action plan I prefer, don't you think?
Yeah, well, I think the one thing that is clear that Democrats are going to focus on policy-wise is the healthcare costs, of course, which they have a different approach than Republicans do. But they see the fact that we have these, you know, enhanced subsidies that were put in place during COVID that are expiring at the end of the year. Democrats see this as an opening not only to hit on affordability, which is clearly their word of the day, word of the week, word of 2026, but also they're going to hit on healthcare, which has proven to be a powerful issue for them over and over again. And so their message already has been, I think will continue to be, to report to voters next year and Republicans, anyone, saying we are going to make healthcare more affordable for you. Republicans have not. Whether that's effective or not in the long run is still an open question. Whether we see some of Trump's economic policies start to kick into gear in a more visible way could also change the game. But right now, it does feel like Republicans are a little bit on the back foot when it comes to the economic issue.
You know what's so interesting? It, with a skill, they could say, wait a second. Does anybody know of a Republican that's for Obamacare? Steph, even with all the connections you have, you probably don't know one. Guess what's been in play for 15 years? Obamacare. And now you're mad at Republicans for not allowing additional money that was put in place temporarily to continue. A program that continues to need more and more subsidies that on the whole need $6,000 of a deductible. Man, if I'm paycheck to paycheck and I have a deductible of $6,000, I'm not happy. But that's what Democrats look like they're looking to preserve, correct?
That is what they're looking to preserve. And they're hoping to, you know, continue these temporary measures, as you pointed out, to continue to keep prices at least a little bit lower. Republicans are making the argument you are that, you know, Obamacare is clearly not working. They say the fact that we continue to see premiums rise regardless of these, you know, additional tax credits, that proves that the system doesn't work and it needs broader change. The question is whether they can actually convince Americans that letting these subsidies expire in the short term is still worth it for some of these longer term ideas Republicans have. And there's division among Republicans over whether that's the right move. There are some who say, yeah, this isn't the best. We have to do what we can to keep prices a little bit lower for people for now, even if it's long term. There are others, as you point out, who say we've never been for Obamacare. We've never supported these policies and we're not going to start now. And that's where this becomes such a tricky issue for the Republican Party.
And I think the knock against Republicans, and it's accurate. Where's your plan? You know, where's your plan? We know you don't like that plan. And we know you feel burned because you're, you know, the whole skinny plan was thumbs down from John McCain. You haven't touched it since, but you should have had a plan. But we all know in the big picture, no plan is ever going to work unless both sides combine on it. Because one is, even if one's genius and one isn't, they're always going to look to rip it apart just because they don't want to give it to the other guys, which is sad about the state. So let's go down into the nitty gritty. Between, there's a few plans kicking around. Bill Cassidy's plan wants to put money into healthcare accounts. Then you got the Problem Solvers Caucus led by Gottheimer and Gottheimer, as well as Brian Fitzpatrick. And they're looking for a plan that would extend the subsidies, but for a year, and they would examine some way forward going forward sometime in this next year. I also think to what you originally said, that Democrats want this as an issue next year, so they probably don't want to compromise at all. Do you think something could get done?
It's one of those things, you know, I've been covering this for months now. I feel like this conversation was ongoing even during the shutdown, and it feels like there is a pathway. The question is whether both parties are willing to walk down that path. You know, there seems to be bipartisan support for some kind of a temporary short-term extension of these subsidies that come with changes like an income cap and, you know, eliminating the $0 premiums and then setting up a broader package, a healthcare package down the road, right? There seems to be, you talk to Republicans and Democrats, and they can seem pretty comfortable with that. The question is whether there's the political will, whether going into 2026, Republicans are willing to take a risk on backing Obamacare subsidies, and whether Democrats are willing to take a risk of fixing a problem that they could campaign on next year.
So I want you to hear Bill Cassidy, what he's offering roughly. He said this on Face the Nation, Cut 31.
the net deductible, if you will, that okay. $1,500 is per person. Give me a couple, you know, for people over 50, give me a couple in their 50s with two children, 18 and 19, they would get $5,000 in an account, in their purse, pocketbook, you name it, in their pocket to pay the out-of-pocket for the insurance. Now, the insurance plan for that couple would be $6,000 deductible. So you end up decreasing the net deductible by doing this. That makes the policy actually functional for them. If the child has a sprained ankle you bring to the urgent care, you can pay the bill, not kind of come for it out of your own pocket. By the way, I'm told that about 40% of Americans have less than $1,000 in their savings account. That kind of puts into relief why you need to have something in their pocket to pay the out-of-pocket.
So you know he's a doctor. You know he is not a deep-down MAGA Republican. He's trying to get something done. The president's open to it. The president almost signed off on just extending the subsidies. So do you know of any Democrat that would sign on to this type of alternative approach?
You know, so far, I spoke to Cassidy last week as well, and he said he hadn't had a lot of conversation with Democrats at this point. I think there are Democrats, even like Senator Jeanne Shaheen, for example, who like this HSA idea. They like the idea in theory of providing more funds for American people to use directly on their health care. The question is whether Democrats are willing to forsake some kind of extension of the subsidies in exchange for this program. And that's where you really start seeing the tension in these plans, where Democrats may be willing to sign on to some kind of an HSA plan that many Republicans have been pushing for a while now, but they're not going to do that without some kind of extension at this point of these expiring subsidies. And people like Senator Bill Cassidy have said, you know, I asked him, like, would you be willing to sign off on some kind of a short-term extension? And he basically said no, which I think that's where you kind of get at the heart of what people are willing to back versus what they're willing to let go of. And we just still see so much tension there between the parties.
Yeah. See, you got to get 60 votes. First, get a majority and then see if they're going to sign on to it and see if they can get something done before Christmas. And then we'll have the expiration of the subsidies. We'll see where we go from here. Lastly, before we go, if you look at the program the way it is right now, if that money goes away, it affects 24 million people, right? Some of those 24 million shouldn't even be eligible for this. There was a pandemic move, 200% above the party poverty line. So how many, when you look at the big picture, what percentage of the American public is really going to be affected by this? Are we overstating the need to reform this?
I mean, look, it's not going to be the majority of Americans who are impacted by this. Many people get their health insurance from employers, from other places, right? They're not on the marketplace, but there are millions of people who will be impacted, whether it's people losing their health insurance, whether it's people having to pay even higher premiums, and premiums are already increasing. So there's no question that there's going to be widespread impact. You know, it's not a majority, and that's where politicians are going to figure out what the risk is here and how many people in their state this could impact. And it's going to depend on state by state and what those populations look like and what the needs look like. So I think you're going to see some lawmakers hit harder by this than others.
Now, where are the voters most persuadable when it comes to the ACA?
You know, we did get a look at some Republican polling that was done recently that showed, first of all, it showed how popular these enhanced premiums are. And, you know, a majority of respondents said that they would like to see those extended. But when they were presented with some of the Republican arguments saying that these aren't actually lowering the cost of health care, or that these were only temporary measures, we did see especially Republican and independent voters shift away from needing to see those subsidies extended. And there was a lot of support for the HSA style solution to this when you looked at the polling. But what was interesting to me is that there were about a majority, about half or more of respondents in that Republican poll who were really willing to back anything that would provide some kind of extension and fix to this problem. So the American people are open to fixes, but these subsidies are still very popular.
Right. And the thing is, in theory, the way I understand it with Obamacare is that Aetna, Cigna, U.S. Healthcare, the big firms were supposed to be able to compete for people. And they were supposed to drive the prices down if there's competition, but they all dropped out. They were losing billions of dollars, especially without the mandate that forced healthy people to get insurance. They didn't have the balance of the unhealthy people. So they said, we're losing billions of dollars. We're out. So we're left with really no choice on the exchange, and the price just keeps going up.
Yeah, I mean, I think both parties will say that it, you know, it hasn't worked the way they thought it would. And there clearly needs to be reforms done to the healthcare system. But then the question is, what is really the priority? It's such a mess. And there's so many different incentives. And, you know, we'll see if there's this conversation is supposed to continue. Republicans say they want to keep talking about it into the next year. We'll see. You know, I have pretty low hopes anything gets done before Christmas. We'll see, though, if there's a willingness to continue working on these issues in January, or mm-hmm. whether we see, you know, the midterm election cycle kind of take over this issue and this get kind of put on the back burner.
All right, Steph Kite, if something's going to happen, you'll be the first with it, just judging by the way your columns and you've been covering it everywhere, all the way through. She's with Axios. Steph, thanks so much. And thanks for going on Zoom.
Thank you.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. We're going to come back and take some of your calls, get your insights. I got emails from this weekend. It was a real bloody weekend. We all saw it. Let's break it down. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course, or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
As my beloved grandmother used to say, between a thief and a liar, I'll take a thief, because you can catch a thief, but you just can't catch a liar. This guy is the most lying grifter hypocrite ever in American politics. And he has just a slick image to prove it. He's just a snake oil salesman.
And now with James Woods out in Los Angeles, joining me on One Nation last night to talk about the front runner for the Democratic nomination. I know it's early, but it's true. He is. Ezra Klein of the New York Times, impactful podcaster, left winger, said that, you know, he's a breath of fresh air, all types of nice stuff. James Woods knows a different story. He's been out there his entire life, watched this guy as a mayor. Watch him now as a two-term governor. Thinks he's the worst. Cut 44.
As fruit farmers always say, early ripe, early rotten. And this guy will make a lot of noise right now, and his polls will go up.
I think that if you look at Gary Beshear and Governor Shapiro, I think that they are more complete candidates. I mean, Beshear does not look great on camera. I mean, he looks like he's afraid to blink. He looks scared to death. And a lot of stuff he says seems to be inaccurate. Like, for example, that 70% of rural hospitals have closed under Trump. It's not even possible. There's not enough nails to board up windows for that. So it's called seven are in critical situations. But were in critical situations, in rural situations in Kentucky before President Trump even had one policy plan okayed or verified, or the big, beautiful bill was even a thought in his head. But having said that, they're going to have to go at Newsom pretty hard. And I don't think they'll have a problem with that. Kamala Harris and Newsom are already fracturing. How soon to Newsom just says Kamala Harris is a waste, she did nothing as a vice president, and then she comes back and says that he was trying to undermine Joe Biden, and it's an intramural fight, game on. I'm not sure that's going to happen that much on the right, especially if Trump stays popular with the whole MAGA movement stays strong. And people might be kind of concerned about, hey, I'd rather get the nomination J.D. Vance, but I'm not going to go after J.D. Vance. So those are a few of the things going on. And also when it comes to what's happening in politics. President of the United States having 42% approval rating, I don't think it's that big a deal. Think about it. You get elected with about 50%. Luckily, if you're lucky, 50%. I mean, Bill Clinton got elected with 43% of the vote for the most part until the very end. He was not over 50, especially in the beginning. There was a lot of buyer's remorse there. So now I think with the president of 42 is not a problem. And things go up if the economy continue to go up. We're going to get real numbers tomorrow. And if you're looking at right now the stock market, indications are those numbers are going to be good. Now, why is it big tomorrow? Because we got nothing in October because of the government shutdown. So we're really, you know, the Fed said, I'm going in complete numbers. I'm just going to cut rates 0.25%. Another cut could be coming. But if the jobs numbers are very high, that might stop the cuts to a degree. But the word is that even though some people are concerned about the number of jobs lost to Obamacare, excuse me, to AI, they're not that worried about the overall numbers. They think they'll be strong then, which means if they'll just worry about inflation, which means if it's under control, then you can cut rates, which could help the housing market. You can see how it's all related. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. I want to see you in Fort Myers on Valentine's Day. Go get tickets. History, Liberty, and Laughs. Streamed on Fox Nation.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Hope you had a good weekend. I know you watched the three horrific events and were probably affected by it. We'll go over those events, but also focus on what else is going on domestically as we also get ready for the holidays. Now, the holidays also mean brace yourself for somebody who want to ruin your holidays, like mass gunfire, like what's happening in Brown and what's happening in different places like Syria and unfortunately what just happened in Australia. So before we get to Stephen Moore at the bottom of the hour to bring us inside the Ukrainian negotiations for bringing that ongoing war to an end, we'll have Moaz Mustafa standing by, the executive director of the Syrian Emergency Task Force, just back from Damascus. Before we get to Moaz, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
I absolutely support President Trump's strategy, and we, the Venezuelan people, are very grateful because I believe he is a champion of freedom in this hemisphere.
That is Marina Corina Machado amping up the intensity in Venezuela, as would be the next leader, salutes Trump and reveals her game plan for taking over the country. After all, she did win the election. Trump and Rubio have plans to tighten the squeeze to force Maduro out.
Number two.
So you've got abundant energy, you've got falling rents, that will push inflation lower. And the president's right. This inflation has been embedded because of 4 years of very pro-inflation, anti-living standards policy.
That is the advisor to Secretary of Treasury Scott Bessent, Joe Livogna. All agree with the midterms are about the economy. We are not stupid. We look at the Trump game plan and look at the stats as we set to start the sprint to the midterms.
Number one.
There was a plethora of warning signs ever since the massacre that occurred on October 7, 2023. The Australian Jewish community, like many other diaspora Jewish communities in the West, have been under a violent and increasingly besieged mentality.
Yeah, by Joel Burney, the Australian Australian journalist. The bloody, brutal weekend. We see American soldiers killed in Syria, 15 Jews murdered by Islamic extremists in Australia, and a mind-numbing mass shooting on the campus of Brown. We outline the attacks and the assailants. First off, let's talk about Syria. And we know that we lost two soldiers, National Guardsmen from Iowa, one of which has been identified, and an interpreter, and some others were wounded as they were doing a relatively routine security patrol, and it happened over the weekend. Moaz Mustafa had just left Damascus, landed, and has a perspective on what's going on. Moaz, describe the situation on the ground now in Syria. There are some areas in which the new government does not control. Is this one of the areas?
That's right. That's right. There's an area called the Badia area, or the desert area of Syria. It goes over a couple of provinces. This is the desert area that includes the city of Palmyra, where this horrific terrorist attack happened. And this is the area where the last remnants of ISIS, as you know, and as the world knows, President Trump and the U.S. military, obliterated the physical geographic caliphate. But the last remnants remain in this Badia area. That's why we've got the brave soldiers that are stationed at the 10th Garrison and the Syrian partner forces that are there in a mission for the final enduring defeat of ISIS that I think can happen under President Trump's watch.
Well, right now, the president has pledged retaliation for what's taken place. He says, no doubt about it. They'll hear from us. In fact, he says, I could tell you, Syria, there will be a lot of damage done. You said there's already they're already starting to move on ISIS in the area?
Oh, right away. First of all, counter ISIS operations in coordination with the new Syrian government has been ongoing against ISIS throughout the past year since the fall of Assad, Russia, Iran, and Syria, and Hezbollah. And right after the president's announcement, it wasn't just a promise. I mean, he started action right away. There have been major sweeps by both U.S. forces and Syrian forces of all the areas and the towns and the villages within the Badia area that we discussed, including in Palmyra. There have been ISIS cells that have already been taken out, networks that have been neutralized, and that continues. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, I mean, this isn't just about, you know, responding to what happened. This is about saving the world from ISIS once and for all. And today, thank God, the partnership between the new Syrian government and the United States military is really, I think, going to be the final blow to ISIS. But this horrible attack by ISIS, there was another one yesterday, targeted Syrian security forces, killed four of them. It just shows how angry and fearful they are of President Trump's policy in Syria, which is bringing them to their final end.
I want Senator Lindsey Graham still a little bit skeptical after he heard about the attack. Listen to him, cut 23.
The Syrian government has signed up to the anti-ISIS program. I support trying to work with the Syrian government, but there's some very nefarious characters around Jelani, the head of Syria. We might want to revisit relieving Caesar Act sanctions to make sure that we have some leverage against the people running Syria.
Do you think we need leverage?
I think, first of all, what Senator Lindsey Graham doing here is literally undermining his president's policy. So I would ask Senator Graham to follow President Trump's lead, to trust President Trump's instincts on this, because what President Trump has ensured is that we got Syria out of the sphere of influence of North Korea and China and Russia and Iran and Hezbollah. And now Syria is desperately trying to become our ally. And the experience and expertise that they have in fighting ISIS, the Syrians, is really important because they've been fighting ISIS without U.S. air cover, without troops or weaponry, and they've been doing it well. Now they have the United States as their sort of, you know, solid backing in that fight against ISIS. Senator Graham, unfortunately, here has no idea what he's talking about. When he mentions the Caesar Act, he should know because he's seen the language. The Caesar Act was about the tyrant Assad. And literally concentration camps where babies were being tortured to death. And Assad is gone. So you don't punish the Syrian people for sanctions that were aimed at a tyrant that they deposed. Senator Graham should follow President Trump's lead, as should everybody else on Syria policy. No other president could have done what he's done in that country.
So why? One thing I would, I'm a little surprised, MOS, and that is that Russia is still there. I mean, Russia has done nothing to win over this government. He's barrel bombing innocent people for years, combining with the Assad to keep him in power. Now, Hezbollah gets dismantled. That opens up the opportunity to overthrow Assad simply because Israel took them apart. And that pushes Iran out, which is awesome. But why keep Russia there?
Oh, well, listen, first of all, Russia had many bases in Syria. Out of each one of them, they were either killed or pushed out and they left. So now they're down to like one base in a small port, both in the same area called Hmeymim base. And I can tell you, if President Trump just messages the Syrian president and says, I want the Russian bases out, those bases would be out right away. The reason that those tiny bases remain is there is some negotiation of saying, hey, the Russians are desperate to stay. They want this one warm water port. They want this one base. I can tell you for sure they're not going to get either. They're going to be kicked out of those last two bases. I can tell you for sure the Russians cannot fly over Syria or go on patrols where they were confronting U.S. patrols sometimes anymore. The Russians are done in Syria. They were geopolitically defeated. The Syrians as a government and more importantly as a people hate them. And it's a matter of time before getting that last base out.
So it didn't get by me that the hero in the shooting in Australia was Syrian, is Syrian. He's alive. And his name is Ahmed 43 years old. Right before he went up to tackle the gunman, which took so much guts, I can't even, you got to see this video. He told his cousin, I'm not going to live. He said, I'm not going to live, but just tell everybody I tried to die like a hero. He ends up taking the gun away from the father. It was a father and son terrorist team, and then held the rifle to him, but didn't shoot. But then the son spots him and shoots him once in the arm and once in the shoulder. He is going to survive. But that's a Syrian. So if anyone wants to generalize and say Muslims hate the West, you're not paying attention to the hero here, right?
Yes. God bless you for saying that. You know, I watched that video as I was getting ready to, you know, for some meeting Syria related. And I was looking at the video. I was actually watching it on Fox. And I was like, what a hero. Like, what a hero that man is. He should be awarded whatever Australia awards its heroes. It's a beautiful thing. But when I found out that it was a Syrian from Idlib, mind you, that province that was the last one that stayed standing up to Assad, Russia, and Iran until the full liberation, it just makes my heart grow so full. And I think what I would tell the American people, I grew up in Arkansas. All my friends served in the military. I myself didn't serve in the military, but had the honor of working with them in dangerous places, as Brian knows. But I want to say that the Syrian people love America and they hate ISIS. That includes the government. And there's so much misinformation out there because Syria has been closed off to the world. Well, today, the whole world gets Syria back. And I invite everyone to visit. Not a single security incident on 29% raise in American tourists to Syria. And you have the straight street where Saul converted to Paul when he saw Jesus Christ. You have the original St. Paul's Church. You have the oldest synagogue in the world destroyed by Iran, Russia, and Assad, but now being rebuilt by the Syrian Jewish community themselves. It's a beautiful thing that happened in Syria, and we wouldn't have had Syria back was it not for the leadership and vision of President Trump, who lifted all sanctions, including the Caesar Act, which is another reminder to Lindsey Graham, focus on America first, because America first means a stable, prosperous, strong Syria that's in our partner in fighting ISIS, not one where we place sanctions from a fallen dictator back on them.
Okay, so the retaliation has already started against after the attack. It's already started. We'll look for even more concrete gains because we know exactly where ISIS is. So they got to go.
Mustafa. They got to go. And sir, yeah. I have to say, sorry, one last second, Brian. The American military is amazing. That same task force saved people under siege, saved babies, gave C-sections to women that would have been life or death during the siege, and fought ISIS. And today, their partnership with Syria and the leadership of CENTCOM, ISIS has no chance. It's a matter of getting the last few cells wherever they may be. And these acts by ISIS are only out of the fear of their final end. Thank you for all the time you've given me.
You got it, Moaz. Thanks so much. Appreciate the insight. When we come back, I'll be able to squeeze in some calls in the bottom of the hour, go inside the latest talks with Ukraine happened in Berlin hours ago. We'll bring you the latest. Stephen Moore coming up then. You're next. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Don't go anywhere. Brian Kilmeade will be right back. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
This week, President Trump led a rally celebrating his handling of the economy, which for some reason he held at a casino in the Poconos. Just kind of weird to say, the future is brighter than ever. Isn't that right, woman on oxygen playing the nickel slots?
That's pretty funny. Did he do something at the Poconos?
Yeah, when he did the economy speech or the affordability stuff last week, that's where he was.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
You know, the Poconos are nice. I mean, there are. It's a great. For a while, it was a honeymoon destination. I thought.
No, agreed. But I mean, they do have the point at like a casino, which I know is probably where he feels very comfortable. But you know, that's not exactly where you're going to find. Like, yes, these are the people that really think the economy is going strong.
So, explain to me what's going on with Rob Reiner. So, we get the word last night that a 78-year-old and 60-something-year-old woman, man and woman, were found dead in Rob Reiner's house.
Correct.
And they're the same age as Rob Reiner and his wife. So horrific story. And then I'm thinking to myself, the way you're describing it, it could be carbon monoxide poisoning. Because you remember Vitas Gerulaitis walked into his pool area, carbon dioxide. That's why you have carbon dioxide detectors. Because I'm thinking to myself, total accident, who's going to be able to make heads or tails of it? Then we find out that it's a stabbing. He was stabbed to death. Well, that's a lot different than, wow, why are these people dead? Cohort attacks, you know, murder, suicide. So they don't want to say anything about anything. I'm looking at the LA Times front page. Rob Reiner's dead. What a career. Really? I mean, that's what happens if you have a heart attack or, if, sadly, if you have cancer. But if you got stabbed to death, again, in Brentwood, where OJ did what we know OJ did. Now, is this something, did they jump to conclusions with OJ and they regret it? I mean, why are they not saying? Then they said they have a family member in custody. And everybody's reporting that it's this drug-addled son.
Yep. People was reporting it last night.
But no one's really reporting it, right? No one's
I think everyone, what I've been listening to, it's like people's reporting, like, you know, it's the son. I think the family put out a statement, I heard someone else say, but they're not, the authorities aren't saying who it allegedly is as of now.
A couple of things. If you have a stabbing next door to you, and they go, don't worry about it, nothing to fear. Well, who did it? I don't know. Excuse me? You don't know, but I have nothing to fear? You can't have it both ways. Somebody was shockingly stabbed to death, and they happen to be famous and rich. Everybody next to them is rich, some of which are famous. They go inside. Famous people are visiting them. Larry David,
yeah,
Billy Crystal.
They said we're walking the streets, just upset.
So what is the negativity about a family member's being interviewed about the stabbing death of Rob Reiner and his wife? Like, why we can't get a policeman to say that?
I guess they want to wait till they have enough facts to say it definitively. They were
interviewing him.
They were saying, like, well, what I saw initially, you know, injuries consistent with stabbing. I read this morning that they it looked like both of their throats were slit. I mean, it was horrible. They said
it's horrible.
The daughter found them. I mean,
that's why I can't play clips. People are like, Rob Reiner's dead. Oh, look at the great show he did. Look at the movie. Like, really? The whole story is there's a mystery to who killed him at 78 years old.
And, but if you want to hear, Jerry O'Connor, O'Connell was on CBS.
Stand By Me.
Point.
He was a kid.
Yes,
Stand By
he was
Me.
11 at the time. But he talked about what Rob Reiner did for him, which is Cut 46.
You know, I don't mean this as any offense to my parents who are still with us and breathing the cold in New York right now. Hi, Mom and Dad. He was like a father to me. You know, I worked with him when I was 11. At that point in my life, I wasn't like getting in trouble criminally, but I was always getting in trouble for speaking out loud in class and like not being able to keep my mouth shut. And my mother would always say, sit on your hands and shut up. Just sit on your hands and shut up. Teachers would always, I get in trouble with teachers. And I got to that set of Stand By Me, and I remember I ad-libbed a scene one day early on in shooting, and he was like, cut, Jerry. And I thought, oh boy, here we go. He's gonna, why didn't I sit on my hands and shut up? And he went, hey, Jerry, keep going, man. That's what I'm talking about right there. Go more. I'm not making a joke, but I know my house is dark. I have everything. Everything I have is because of Rob Reiner.
Wow.
Everything I have.
Yeah, I mean, Stand By Me was based off, was it Stephen King? Or it was some famous writer. The movie was... right? Am I right with that?
He's shaking his head. He's our authority.
Yeah, Stephen King was based on his short novella called The Body.
Yeah, so he took it, you know, obviously the song, and he thinks he's a good director. But do you know, on the other note, he's no more for politics. I'm telling you, more than, because he didn't star in a lot of his movies after all in the family, like he had roles in, I think, the sequel to Harry Met Sally, but Spinal Tap, another one. But he was so adamant and so upset when Trump won the second time, he had to go away. He went into an institution. I mean, think about how crazy he went with politics. And he says that he's credited his wife with his activism. So, I mean, his dad wasn't like that. His dad lived to almost 100. Carl Reiner.
Yeah.
So his dad lived, and Carl Reiner famously came up with the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Yeah. Well. So, Trump put out a statement that is, you have to, you know, it's very Trump. He basically said, a very sad thing happened last night in Hollywood. Rob Reiner, a tortured and struggling but once very talented movie director and comedy star, has passed away, together with his wife, reportedly due to the anger he caused others through his massive, unyielding, and incurable affliction with the mind-crippling disease known as Trump derangement syndrome. It goes on. Eventually, he says, rest in peace. Eventually. a little too soon.
Well... We'll get answers soon, and then we'll be willing to put it all in perspective. Listen to Brian Kilmeade Show. Stephen Moore's next.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We had conversation with the United States team about possible security guarantees for Ukraine. And we are working on a framework document. And it must be strong enough to truly work. We believe this document should be approved by the United States Congress. This would mean real, solid, legally binding security guarantees for our country.
So that is President Zelensky talking about why he was going to Berlin and what he hopes to get out of it. You know, they want him to give up all the Donbass region. They still hold on to 32% of it and have fought to hold off for, you know, what is it, like 15 years. Number two is General Keane was just on. He said anybody who says they're about to lose Donbass doesn't know what's going on the ground. It would take him at the best, 3 more years to win back all of the Donbass. Why would you give it away? Maybe it is a demilitarized area. Maybe that's a concession. But do you realize we're conceding and we're talking with just one side? When the Russians get this done out of Berlin and when the Ukrainians say, okay, if I can get Parliament to say yes on this, I'll give you this. When the Russians get it, what's going to happen? Stephen Moore joins us now, former chief of staff of the U.S. House and founder of the Ukrainian Freedom Project, which raises money to aid Ukraine. He goes back and forth. Steve, welcome back.
Great to be here.
You weren't in Berlin, but you know what went on in Berlin.
Yeah.
So there's some talks about the 28 plan to 19 to now 20 points. What do you hear from the Ukrainian side?
Well, you know, you're speaking of the land they're trying to give away in Donbass. Steve Witkoff seems obsessed with giving away land of the Donbass.
Donetsk.
Yeah. And we were in that land in September. We went to a place called Slavyansk. And, I asked people, what do you think about being ruled by the Russians? You might be surprised to learn it was not a popular thing to ask.
You're being sarcastic.
Oh, yeah. So people don't want the Russians. And the reason that Putin is so fixated on this is that, you know, for those of us who remember World War II history, the Maginot Line was the French defensive fortification that were supposed to keep the Germans out for World War II. And this is the reason why Putin hasn't been able to take it in, you know, since 2014 is because it's heavily fortified. There's natural barriers. It's difficult to take. Now he wants to.
And if you get past it, it's a direct line to Kyiv.
Yeah. The war does not go well after that. You know, it's much harder. And so, anything that Vladimir Putin talks about for a peace plan is just a way for him to advance his purposes to invade all of Ukraine and the rest of Europe. And, he's already in violation of 25 ceasefires and peace agreements with Ukraine, the one that lasted the longest, 4 months. So it is absurd to think that there's anything in this peace plan that will make Putin keep his word.
But is there stuff in the peace plan, for example, a lot of the unfrozen funds, the frozen funds gets unfrozen and go to Ukraine and part of the rebuilding process, security guarantees from NATO nations who says we'll put troops in. And obviously Russia says, no, we don't want that. But UK and France, whoever thought that? They put troops there, be the tripwire. So even though they invaded, they took land that doesn't belong to them, they stole it. If you end up with a fortified Ukraine, which is the second biggest army in Europe and clearly pound for pound the best.
Yeah.
They might say, OK, now I'm going to be part of the West, be part of the European Union. I won't join NATO. But man, I got some NATO forces there. You could see how how a maybe war-torn country says, maybe I'll just take a breath here for a while and start rebuilding my life and get our, get the prisoners back.
Well, Brian, and that is what it is. It's me taking a breath because Putin's not going to stop. You know, Putin right now spends between $35 and $45 billion annually on salaries and death benefits for soldiers that are killed in Ukraine. And if he can stop spending that for a period of time, you know, that much money is about 1 million drones. So he can build 1 million drones with that amount of money. And, you know, then, you know, he just starts flying those things all over Europe and any place else he wants to.
But does he really want to? For example, he's got his hands full of Ukraine. Does he really want a piece of Norway? Really want a piece of Finland? Does he really want to go into Poland? Poland's building a wall. They're training harder every day. I'm watching 60 Minutes yesterday. The Germans are rearming. And I'm thinking to myself, is this just lip service? No, they're not. They have actually, they said that their recruitment is up 22%. They are now up their budget by 80% by 2029, up their military budget by 80%. We watched them doing drills. They've done the impossible. How long have Americans asked NATO, Europe, to start defending themselves, put their own money into their own defense, put at least 2% into NATO? You know who's helped them? Trump, because he looks like he really walk away, number one. And number two, Vladimir Putin, because he really is going to invade. It's not a theory anymore.
Yeah, totally. You know, for 4 years, the Europeans have sent more money to Russia for petroleum products than they have to Ukraine for its defense. And finally, they're turning around that around. And they've been talking a lot. Macron talks a lot, and the Belgians talk a lot, and the Italians talk a lot. They don't do anything. I have real hope for the Germans now.
I have hopes for the Italians.
Is that right?
I know it's tough because their economy is a little backwards, but Meloni gets it. And she's already starting to retake areas where they let massive immigration in and they've lost the Italian culture. I think they understand, too, the threat that China has. So I think it'll be harder for them. I think she woke up first, or okay, one of the first. So I'm a little bit optimistic there. I want you to hear what Jack Keane said. He sounds like you about Russia not changing.
Yeah.
Russia has not changed their desires here. They want to pocket whatever concessions the United States and Ukraine are willing to make, and then at some point that's convenient for them, it is guaranteed they will try to re-attack and take the country. That is their objective, and then expand into Eastern Europe. We can never lose sight of where Russia really is on this.
And they haven't shown anything different.
Yeah.
So that's why I just think Trump says Zelensky and they're both a problem. Okay, not anymore. When Zelensky signs off on this, when they get it right, it'll be, okay, your move. And you can't spin it any other way. They already hard signed it.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. You know, and Republicans, we polled Republican primary voters in October, and by 5-1, they think that Putin is the problem versus Zelensky.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's the easiest question ever asked, by the way. So tell me about the other thing we get from critics is, well, if Zelensky's such a great leader, why is he shutting down the church, the Catholic Church in Ukraine, the Russian Orthodox Church? Why is that?
Well, listen, the Russian Orthodox Church is not a church as you and I would think of one. It is a working arm of the Kremlin. The Patriarch Kirill of the Russian Orthodox Church has declared a holy war on Ukraine and the West. And he has said that if you die fighting in Ukraine, all your sins will be washed away. And
they're buying that?
Yeah, well, he stopped short of 72 virgins. But, it's the same sort of weaponization of religion to gain martyrs that the Islamic extremists do.
But they're
do.
Working the cause of Capitol Hill?
They are. They're, this week, there's an organization called the Russian Orthodox Church Outside Russia, at ROKOR, as they're known. And there's a little bit more than 100 churches but they report to Kirill. They're an American church that reports to Kirill. You can look at the website of their diocese, the governing body. There's pictures of Kirill there. There's a bunch of references to Kirill. Kirill, again, is the guy that has helped shut down every church in occupied Ukraine. You mentioned Catholics. There is not a Catholic priest left in occupied Ukraine. You know why? Because Kirill has declared a holy war on Ukraine and the West. And so on Ukraine and you, man, you know, the West, that's us. So the Russian Orthodox Church is not a trustworthy organization. And all I know about ROKOR is that they have pictures of Kirill plastered all over their websites.
So a couple of things. I don't think that Trump's tactics are bad. For example, it's very easy to go in and go, the good guys, bad guys, right? Vladimir Putin, you've been a problem. You want to be Hitler. The German leader, Merz, just said that he believes he's as bad as Hitler. Ironically, he would know. So yeah. I got it. But he said, but Trump just says, how do I end this? I don't end this by saying good guy, bad guy, because I'll never get. So he goes in and goes, look, I don't know how this started. Never would have started with me. What do you need? What do you need? Back and forth, back and forth. Now, I don't mind. Like, I think when it's all said and done, he's going to say, yeah, I thought I'd give this guy a window back in. I'd give him an off-ramp back into maybe getting to the G8.
Yeah.
If you don't want to take it, you don't want to take it.
Yeah.
So he goes in there and let Macron and everybody and Biden and say, Vladimir Putin and you and I, Steve Moore, say he's the enemy. I think he probably knows that.
Yeah.
But he just says, okay, how do I get these sides together by calling them the enemy?
Yeah.
So I think he drives some people crazy on the right and left by saying, why do you give Vladimir Putin so much leeway? Because he has more, he's a more powerful country. If this ends, if he's able to end this in a sustainable way, and sustainable, I think, is with security guarantees that says if you invade, you've hit the West.
Yeah.
I mean, that's basically what you're saying. You're starting war in Europe.
Yeah.
Would they have gone in 3 years ago if it would have been war with France and England, Germany? Probably not.
No. Well, he lives in an echo chamber. Vladimir Putin lives in an echo chamber. You know, by all accounts, during COVID, he was scared to death of COVID, spent all his time in the Russian archives deep in the basement of the Kremlin. And he got this idea that he could be the next Peter the Great. And that has stuck with him. He has changed mentally due to COVID, as many of us did. And so what we're seeing is that Russia and China are working together. You know, there's actually a Chinese drone company that took a stake in a Russian drone company to manufacture drones to kill Europeans.
Using the template from Iran.
Yeah, exactly.
The Al-Shahid.
Oh, listen, you know, Anya and I live in Kyiv. We hear those Iranian-made drones fly over our heads, and then they explode someplace. Fortunately, they'll explode at our apartment. So, but, you know.
But they're run by AI now, no longer a kid with a joystick.
Yeah, yeah. We are not ready for this war, man. Our stuff does not work in Ukraine.
But you know who might? Ukraine.
Yeah.
Ukraine might be ahead. They're making their own stuff now.
Yeah.
They're making their own long-range missiles.
Oh, man, they're making more than that. So the drone war changes weekly. And so if America manufactures a bunch of drones right now and keeps them in a warehouse somewhere, you know, the drone war will completely have changed by the time we get those things out and use them. And, you know, again, I know three different types of U.S. drones that do not work in Ukraine.
So a couple other things. We're talking to Steve Moore. Steve is a former chief of staff at the House Ukrainian Freedom Project founder. So the U.S. and Ukraine are targeting 1,000 vessels, dark fleet, beat up vessels full of oil.
Yeah.
That are dark, meaning hard to track, not on the grid, not labeled. You don't know what port they're going into. Why would that be important? Because that's how Russia's sustaining this fight. People who know they're sanctioned Russian oil, well, I'll get it from the dark fleet.
Yeah.
I'll get cheap oil, helps my people, helps my economy.
Absolutely.
And no one else knows about it. Looks like we do know about it. Looks like Ukraine has underwater submarine submersibles that are blowing these things up.
Well, it'd be nice to see a U.S. destroyer pull up along one side of those things and alongside one of those things and say,
just listen, take it.
Yeah, what you're doing is against international law in several different ways. You know, why don't you go into port with us? You know, that would make a real statement. And, you know, it's not that we don't have enough sanctions. It's just they're not well enforced. And, you know, Russia is a gas station with an army. You take out the gas station, the army has a lot of trouble functioning. So, yeah.
How do you feel about the elections? Zelensky goes, yeah, if you want elections, I'll do elections, even though constitutionally, during war, they're not supposed to have them. But he goes, I'll go do it. Is he popular?
So here's, you know, so Zelensky.
Because we know about this corruption.
Yeah, Zelensky was firmly in second place prior to February. When Trump beat up on him, it rocketed him into first place. I don't know if you've ever seen Animal House, but there's a great scene in there where they're playing golf and there's one of their pledges being beat up by the ROTC guy. And he says, you can't do that to our pledges. Only we can do that to our pledges. And so that's the way the Ukrainian people felt, right? No one can do that to our president. Only we can. So Zelensky actually went back into the top place after that.
Who's
so,
in first?
There's a guy, Zeluzhny, who is the former general of the armies. He's currently the ambassador to the UK. The guy's really popular. It will be a hard-fought fight. I actually think Zelensky in an election may lose. The corruption thing is a huge thing.
Because Yermak is close to him.
Yeah, Yermak is his business partner. They've been together for years. And actually, I'll tell you
about... And he's the one implicated in all of it.
Yeah, but here's the good news, is that every time there's a corruption scandal, someone gets fired. So Yermak, gone. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court is in prison for a $24,000 bribe. There's the former defense minister was fired.
I just don't understand. Yermak... He knows he's tight with Zelensky. They know they're in a fight literally for their lives and for the lives of their country. And they're taking money, the accusation is, of energy?
Yeah.
That should be going to rebuilding their grid or protecting their grid? How do you do that?
Yeah, man. You just got to be a really bad person, you know. And it's frustrating for those of us that don't aren't Ukrainian.
That aren't bad people.
Yeah, and we're working really hard. And, you know, I don't know if you read much about Churchill, but the guy encouraged his daughter-in-law, 20-year-old daughter-in-law, to have affairs with U.S. generals and diplomats so he could get information from them on how to pull America into the.
Did I know that?
Yeah, that is true. Pamela Churchill, now Pamela Harriman, she died in 1996. Great book called Kingmaker, the story of Pamela Harriman. But yeah, so that was how committed that Winston Churchill was. Mm-hmm. And then you see your mock who can't keep his hand out of the till. He's on one hand, please give us more money. The other hand, he's got it in the till.
Well, it just, for people that back, you know, the Ukrainian government as the good guys, it's really a shot to the solar plexus.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah, it's tough for those of us that are. I mean, listen, I'm not over there, man. I'm risking my life to do what I'm doing right now. And I'm not over there to protect your Mac while he steals.
And who's a close friend, longtime friend of Zelensky.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
he either let him down or he was part of it. I would hope that he's not part of it. I don't think he is. Stephen Moore, if people want to help you out with the Ukrainian Freedom Project, where do they go?
Yeah, there's ukrainefreedomproject.org. I also have a Substack, which people might be interested in. It's called Tales from World War III. StephenMoore.substack.com. Tales from World War III.
Moore, M-O-O-R-E.
M-O-O-R-E. S-T-E-V-E-N-M-O-O-R-E.
Appreciate what you're doing, Stephen. Thanks so much.
Hey, great to be with you always. Yeah.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show.
With the holidays coming, that means more gift buying and more deliveries to the front door. It made me think about how I should upgrade my security to keep away the porch pirates and keep my delivery safe. I went with SimpliSafe because it's proactive. Traditional systems react after a break-in. SimpliSafe can help stop a crime before it starts. That's because SimpliSafe keeps your home safe with a double layer of defense. First, you got cameras detecting potential threats, and then live agents confront them while they're still on the outside of your home before they have a chance to do any damage, telling them they're on camera and telling them the police will be dispatched if they do not leave. That's right, if they don't leave. That's why I trust SimpliSafe at my place to help protect my family, keep an eye on the dogs, and watch those deliveries, because real security stops crime before it starts. Right now is such a good time to get SimpliSafe. This month only, get 50% off any new system. Go to simplysafe.com/Brian. Again, that's simplysafe.com/Brian. There's no safe like SimpliSafe.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
According to a new report, people in Long Island spend more money on OnlyFans than some entire Eastern European nations. Because Eastern Europeans are too busy working on OnlyFans.
So I did not know. Is that a true fact?
I mean, it's Weekend Update. They only state the truth.
I'm gonna say something that's really going to get you first laughing.
Oh, no.
Tell me the concept behind this.
OnlyFans?
So you pay a subscription? So, Eric, you do it. I don't think Allison could do it. Do you know the concept behind?
I think basically you can.
You think.
You pay someone to do whatever you want them to do on camera.
But then how would that not be a social media death spiral?
Because you only get to see it, you're paying for the extra content.
Do we believe that?
Well, that people aren't sharing it. I'm not sure about the intricacies of the website or the app.
So you pay people to do things.
Yeah, or it's like is it just specific, or you can have like a broader account? Like you get to pay for a certain tier of seeing extra content of maybe feet, whatever you might be into. Really, I think it can range the gamut of how people make money there. I do appreciate you pretending not knowing what it is, though, Brian.
I wish I was pretending.
I know.
I always said OnlyFans. I'm like, yeah, I don't know what that is. See, I thought it was a sports-oriented thing.
That's what you said when people are like, what are the OnlyFans bills? You're like, it's sports.
All right. So if you could educate me on some modern-day negative situated things that you could be doing with your free time, meet you on February 14th. History, Liberty, and Laughs. Streamed on Fox Nation. On stage, Fort Myers, Florida, BrianKilmeade.com. We're going to announce a whole bunch of other dates, too.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
From the Fox Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here. Hope you had a fantastic weekend, even though it's going to be tough after the three horrific incidents that we're witnessing. Maybe a fourth now as we hear about the arrest, according to page six, of Rob Reiner's son implicated in the murder of Rob and his wife, which would be his mother and father. Dan Senor standing by. Tommy Lahren is here at the bottom of the hour. And before we get to them, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
I absolutely support President Trump's strategy, and we, the Venezuelan people, are very grateful because I believe he is a champion of freedom in this hemisphere.
Yep, Maria Corina Machado, the Nobel Prize winning rightful leader, her party anyway, of Venezuela, talking about amping up the intensity in Venezuela to make sure that she takes over. And if she does take over, she says she's got a plan for the first 100 days and beyond. Trump and Rubio have plans to tighten the squeeze on Maduro. Will it get him out by Christmas? We'll discuss it.
Number two.
So you've got abundant energy. You've got falling rents. That will push inflation lower. And the president's right. This inflation has been embedded because of 4 years of very pro-inflation, anti-living standards policy.
So Scott Bessent of Treasury's assistant, Joe Lavogna, all agreed the midterms are about the economy. And no, they are not stupid with the Trump White House. We look at the Trump game plan and look at the stats as we start the sprint to the midterms.
Number one.
There was a plethora of warning signs ever since the massacre that occurred on October 7, 2023. The Australian Jewish community, like many other diaspora Jewish communities in the West, have been under a violent and increasingly siege mentality.
Yeah, Joe Burney, an Australian official, the bloody, brutal weekend. We have two American soldiers killed in Syria, 15 Jews murdered by Islamic extremists in Australia, a mind-numbing mass shooting on the campus of Brown University. We outline the attacks and the assailants. Dan Senor, former foreign policy advisor to the Bush administration, very successful podcast, says Call Me Back, and co-author of The Genius of Israel. Dan, welcome.
Hey, Brian.
So are you one of the people who are critical of this Australian government for not jumping on the anti-Semitism when it was brought to their attention repeatedly?
Yeah, I will say a few things. One, this government, the Australian government, we know what the Australian government – I had a journalist from Australia, a Jewish journalist on my podcast this morning, who said we know what – and I just want to quote her. She said we know what it looks like when the government has zero tolerance for something. Right. She said during the COVID, for instance, the government had very extreme measures to
I remember the video.
Right. And if you moved like a little few steps too far out of your neighborhood or out of your home, you got whacked with like a $5,000 fine. They made it very clear. That was probably pretty extreme. But the point is, she said, we know when the government cares about something. There was so much incitement going on in mosques in Australia, in the public square in Australia. 2 days after October 7th, mm-hmm. there was a protest in front of one of the opera's houses, the major opera houses in Australia, where they were chanting "Gas the Jews." Nothing was done to shut this down. So they allowed for this very permissive environment for this kind of incitement to occur, first of all. Second of all, the language. Globalize the intifada. You cannot have an abstract or academic reaction or interpretation of that language. That language is very clear. It means slaughter Jews, slaughter them wherever they are, including in Australia, and that no one tried to stare down that language and the perpetrators of the spread of that language, of that rhetoric, and shut that down was utterly irresponsible. The analogy I heard from Eli Lake on a recent commentary podcast, he said it would be like a KKK or neo-Nazi group marching in front of a black church in the South, chanting, "The South will rise again," and the leaders of that state saying, you know, it's not the language we would use,
right,
which is basically what Mamdani says here, by the way, globalize the intifada. He says, it's not the language I would use. Really, it's not the language you would use. How about staring down the people who use that language and having zero tolerance for it? That's not what happened in Australia, tragically. And I worry that that's, you know, there's tolerance for that kind of language here.
So I want you to hear this guy, Joel Burney. He's the executive manager of Australian, Israel and Jewish Affairs Council. He's over there in Sydney, cut 11.
In Australia, the writing was on the wall no less than 48 hours after the events that occurred in Israel during the infiltration of Hamas terrorists killing 1,200 Israelis, no less than 48 hours, there was a protest out the steps of the Opera House in Sydney. That, the writing was on the wall from that moment. The police were there in attendance. They watched. They let it go. And it was a sign to all of the closeted anti-Semites in Australia that now was the time to come out and vandalise our institutions, to burn our cars, to attack our leaders, to burn down our synagogues, to attack our schools, increasingly violent, incrementally over time. The government finally acts and figures out that Iran is behind many of the attacks as well. But yes, the writing was on the wall. The warnings were all there. And unfortunately, government failed to act appropriately.
So why do you think that is?
Because there's a couple things going on here. One, there is a large Muslim population in Australia that has been immigrated into the country legally, I should add. Someone pointed out to me this morning, who's Australian but now lives in the UK, that in the UK they have the same situation with a large Muslim population, not all of which, but segments of it have been radicalized. Many of them have come into the UK illegally. In the case of Australia, they've come in with the full blessing of the Australian government. They've come in legally. And again, I don't want to – obviously there was a hero at Bondi Beach yesterday who was Muslim who saved lives. So I don't want to apply broad stroke. Right. I don't want to apply a broad stroke here, but segments of the population – have been radicalized. They were radicalized before they arrived or after they arrived. While they have been legally immigrated, they have not been assimilated. And then you combine that with the government not willing to confront. So there's I think political considerations with the government not willing to confront those segments of the population, A. And B, I think there's some sympathy for the worldview they espouse, which is to say, I'm not suggesting for a moment, I want to be clear, that the government is rooting for the slaughtering of Jews. Absolutely not. It's the last thing the government wants. But they are sympathetic to the message of globalize the intifada. Not that they want Jews slaughtered, but they see in that a Palestinian pursuit of self-determination, Palestinian freedom. They've latched onto these causes. Sorry?
Didn't they already push for a Palestinian state?
Well, they pushed for a Palestinian state. And what was so demoralizing and ghoulish about the way they pushed for a Palestinian state is they did it while Hamas was still in control of most of Gaza. They did it while they were living hostages in the tunnels of Gaza being held by Hamas. And they basically said, we want to give Hamas, they wouldn't say Hamas, we want to give the Palestinians a state without a condition that Hamas leave Gaza, without a condition that Hamas disarm, without a condition that the Jews, that the Israelis be freed from the tunnels. So it sent a message that they were for Hamas being a midwife of the creation of a Palestinian state, which would have established October 7th, not as a day that, you know, to paraphrase, should live in infamy, but as a day that was Palestinian Independence Day. So again, when the government is doing these things, I'm not suggesting for a moment that they want their Jewish citizens to be killed. But what on earth do they think radicalized segments of their population are going to interpret when the government is rallying to the Palestinian cause when it advantages Hamas?
So let me ask him. I can't recite to you the Australian gun laws, but how is this guy licensed to have six guns?
I don't know.
Think about where he's coming from. Right. How was he on the street?
Well, one of them was apparently on the radar of the law enforcement.
But they still
got
to keep their guns.
Yeah.
Which here is not unusual. Maybe a little bit.
Right.
You know, red flag law.
Right, right.
But the other thing is, four cops sitting there for 20 minutes, they didn't use their guns.
Right.
And as some bystanders have said, a number of them, they were like frozen. Now, did they all four of them freeze? It's almost impossible. Did any of them get through the academy? You freeze during mass shootings?
Yeah.
Or did you say to yourself, it's not a problem? That's
I'm not sure I diagnosed it as not a problem. But I think it's probably more likely that they just froze and didn't know what to do. I will tell you, I am shocked by what I saw yesterday. I'm not surprised by it. I tragically think this was inevitable, that there'll be more and more events like this around the world. So this is the new normal for Jews in the diaspora. This aspect where the cops are just sitting and not doing anything, that to me, I'm shocked by and surprised by.
Yeah, so the founder of and the president of Barstool, Dave Portnoy, he's been speaking up a lot lately, and he said this, cut 15.
I've said it over and over, but no matter what the Jews do right now, it's their fault. Colleges, what other – you see colleges where Jews are openly being intimidated on campus and administrators do nothing and just allow it. It just increases and increases and increases.
He went on to say this, cut 16.
Every single day I would say I get 30 to 50, kill yourself, Jew, you should die, Jew, anti, every single day. That is new. That's unsettling. But, you know, you got to be loud and you got to kind of be proud. Be like, it's not us. We're not the problem. They may want to make it seem like Jews are the problem. No, no, no. We're not the problem. It's all these other idiots. And I'm not talking about the conflict in Israel. I'm talking about just pure hatred in the United States right now for no apparent reason.
And this guy would prefer to focus on sports, right. Obviously. He's right. A commentator on a lot of stuff. He's got some fundamental common sense.
And he doesn't actually speak out on the issue of Israel. He's not known to be.
He has been lately.
Lately. But I'm just saying he's been feeling the anti-Semitism. And this is a very important point with Davis, the point Dave's making. The targets of violence, harassment, vandalism have been Jewish kosher restaurants, obviously Jewish synagogues, Jewish day schools, institutions where Jews are living normal lives in the West, and there's nothing about the way they're living their life that says, I stand with the, you know, the Israeli government's war in Gaza. I'm sure many of them do, but the point is they're not making a statement about Israel, about a geopolitical conflict, you know, 6,000-7,000 miles away from where the community exists. It's purely a function of them being Jewish. And that's what I think people don't appreciate, that this is an attack on Jews and Jews everywhere.
I want to talk about Gaza if we can. I hear Indonesia and Azerbaijan are the only countries that have stepped up to say, we'll give troops to take over the green zone from the Israelis. Turkey said, what about us? We said, Israel says, I don't want Turkish troops in Gaza. Yeah. So what should those international troops look like? Are we ever going to get to phase two?
I think that those two countries are right now the top candidates for are playing a security role in Gaza.
4,000, 3,000?
I don't know the number, but I think the real question now is, can somebody, whether it's the U.S. or Israel, get the Saudis or the Emiratis to participate in that troop presence in some way? I think you need
some. Do you think they want them? Do you think Israel would be comfortable with the Saudis there?
Yeah, much more than the Turks. Absolutely. The Turks, they're genuinely concerned about, because the Turks they see as a geopolitical threat to Israel in the region. The Saudis and the Emiratis, they don't. And the interesting thing about the Saudis and the Emiratis, especially the Saudis, is they have a history and a real track record now of de-radicalization of segments in their own population. So it's not just that they can provide security forces. They can go into these places and they actually know what to do, or at least they've done it in the past in their own countries, in changing the tone and the culture of Jew hatred. And that is what's needed in Gaza, far beyond Hamas. This is a problem that's pervasive in the Palestinian
How much of Gaza is Hamas control over still? I know they just killed the leading commander, one of the people involved.
Yeah, well, Hamas is basically dominant in about 47% of Gaza. Right now, Israel's in 53%. The IDF is still present in 53% of Gaza. But there are these competing factions that are these different militias and different power centers that are trying to pressure Hamas. But right now, Hamas has not been disarmed, and Hamas and Gaza has not been demilitarized. And as long as that's the case, Hamas is going to have more capabilities than these other competing forces, which is why we need to get some kind of force in there.
I hear you. Dan Senor, thanks so much. Check him out on Call Me Back podcast.
Can I just mention one other quick thing before you send me off? There's an organization that needs support after these attacks in Australia, Chabad.org, Chabad.org. I've been posting on X this morning. This is the Jewish organization that organized the Hanukkah celebration on Bondi Beach where the attacks occurred. And I'm just saying, I know Fox has been promoting different efforts to help these communities. This is one I highly recommend.
Got it. Thanks so much, Dan.
Thank you.
Back in a moment.
Real talk, real guests, real insight. Where curiosity meets conversation. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
200 arrested at Vietnam Day peace demonstration. 200. They should have thrown a whole bunch of them in the can. What the hell are them peace thieves want anyhow?
Well, I think they just don't like the idea of America fighting an illegal and immoral war.
Well, if they don't like it, they can lump it.
Well, what would our leaving solve? I mean, with or without protesters, this country would still have the same problems.
What problems?
Well, it's the war, the racial problem, the economic problem, the pollution problem.
Oh, come on, if you want a nitpick.
Let me tell you something, Mr. Punker.
No, let me tell you something, Mr. Stivic. You are a meathead.
What did you call me?
A meathead, dead from the neck up. Meathead.
And that, of course, is Archie Bunker, Carol O'Connor going after an emerging star in Rob Reiner, Meathead, and that was the guy. He's the left wing, married to Sally Struthers. If you don't see it, because they don't like to put Archie Bunker up there anymore. I think we had a better sense of humor in the 70s when that was the number one show in the country. And until it became Archie's place, and it was no longer funny. But he was it was a great example. It was a lot of fun. Everyone had T-shirts that had him, and that's what his reputation was. Then he became a director producer, and now Page Six is reporting that his son has been arrested for the stabbing death of Rob Reiner and his wife. So I don't know. Do we know if this son is that his mother? I mean,
yes.
He was married before
to Penny Marshall. He had one child before, and then three with his current wife. And this is one of the three he had with her.
History of drug problems
and mental health issues.
Yeah, no kidding. So this is just ugly all around. 78 in the high 60s for the mom. And we'll look forward. No one's rushing to get to the bottom of this, but I think people understand where this is going. And the fact that police didn't say, look out, rich people in Brentwood, there could be a killer on the loose, makes me think that they know it's not a killer on the loose. It's the son, and he's and they got him. Meanwhile, I was talking politics over the weekend with James Woods, a famous actor, and he can't believe that Gavin Newsom is the front runner to be president because he knows the guy has done a terrible job, multi-billion dollars in debt for the state. People are leaving in droves. We know about the gas prices. We know about the burning of the Palisades. Did nothing, no water, no accountability. Here's what he said. Cut 43.
As my beloved grandmother used to say, between a thief and a liar, I'll take a thief because you can catch a thief, but you just can't catch a liar. This guy is the most lying grifter hypocrite ever in American politics. And he has just a slick image to prove it. He's just a snake oil salesman.
But he looks the part. And as I said on One Nation, you know, when Eisenhower was a rookie politician, you don't know what kind of president he's going to be, but you have a good idea. Just won World War II. You know, when you have JFK take over, okay, a one-term senator, I get it. He's out there, he's young, he's ambitious, but he outlined exactly what he would do. And you saw what he was as a senator, and you saw the speeches he made, and he was a finalist to be a vice presidential candidate in the election prior. He ended up not getting it. And then he becomes a nominee, takes on the establishment, runs against Eisenhower's record and wins. And then you go get Reagan, two-term governor, fails against Ford to get the nomination. By the time he gets the presidency or runs, you thought, okay, these are what he believes this kind of president will be. Gavin Newsom's telling you he'd be a terrible president. He let the border go wild. He changes with the wind. He was giving illegal immigrants full medical benefits, and they're causing a lot more illegal immigrants. He put the whole state into basically a recession because of it. And then he quickly changed course. He said he'd get rid of homelessness. It becomes the number one homeless capital of the country. So there's nothing he's done right. And as a mayor, he's even more awful. I just thought it would be important for people in California to tell us what kind of governor he is. Whatever you think of DeSantis, he's been an unbelievably successful governor. Beshear and Shapiro are considered very successful governors. This guy is not. Even though he looks like he is, don't be fooled.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back. So, Tommy Lahren, you had an intense weekend, 6 hours on the air minimum, and it was three murders. I mean, you had three, one, we know what happened in Australia, and then we see what happened at Brown University, and then we find out a little bit later what is happening in we were with Rob Reiner, and then we find out earlier, I guess the first one was Syria.
Yeah.
So incredible weekend, right? Did you have all breaking news on the big weekend show?
We thought we were going to be mostly covering what happened in Syria and then obviously other breaking news from the week. But the Brown University stuff really broke. I guess the attention really broke during our hours. I mean, it happened at 4, and so we were on the air at 5. So we covered that for the rest of the night. We did 4 hours of coverage on that and watched the changing story. We had the Truth Social from the president saying very early on that they had a suspect and then retracting that, and then the press conferences and the back and forth. And it was a lot of back and forth. So covering it live, I guess Joey and I definitely have a different perspective because we watched some of the changing narratives and the behavior at the press conferences, which struck us as different.
So here is the mayor surprising us with this. Cut 17.
Shortly, we will be releasing the person of interest who had been detained earlier today. And the Attorney General can speak a little bit about the rationale for that. But we want to inform the community that that individual will shortly be released from Providence Police. We know that this is likely to cause fresh anxiety for our community.
So that was shocking.
Yeah. Last night. Yeah, shocking. Yeah.
26. We thought it was a 26-year-old that was from Wisconsin, that was in the military, that was by a hotel right by the airport.
Right. Which none of it, to me, really tracked. That didn't make a lot of sense why somebody, and again, you never know somebody's motivations, why they travel. We've seen that before. But it just didn't really fit everything that we had heard up to that point. But also, if you think about how quickly they put out the photo of this kid, I think Washington Post was the first one to put it out. We never did. And that was a choice that we obviously made at Fox that we weren't going to put that out. Thank goodness we didn't, because it turned out to be the wrong guy. But wow, what a lawsuit for that guy. Probably for some other folks out there. They put out his picture. They dug into his background. That was a real mess up.
So do you think it's right just to say move on? They moved on? Or do you think that he could have some type of role in it? Because they did say we've released a person of interest. They didn't say we exonerated him. He's no longer a suspect.
Yeah.
Am I reading too much into that?
I feel like if they had any reason to detain him, they would. I feel like it's just the wrong guy. I mean, again, we don't know. But it feels like it's just completely the wrong guy. And if you look, and again, all we have is that little, 3-second clip of him rounding a corner, whoever it is. I'm not somebody who analyzes body language or somebody's stride, but when you looked at the photo of the kid that they put out as their person of interest and the way that that person was walking, it just didn't fit the build or the body type to me. But that was just because we watched 4 hours of that footage of him rounding that corner, and I had a lot of exposure to it.
So they said there was no camera. He went in the side door, didn't need a key pass, walked in, must have known that. And he walked into the classroom and started shooting up, which seems to be mostly sophomores. So you said there's over 500 cameras on Brown
campus. Over 800 cameras.
800 cameras.
Yeah.
But yet, so if you don't have cameras in that classroom, that doesn't mean you don't have it. The exit of the classroom, they came back and they said, well, it's an older building. So what? Yeah. I mean, you could put a Ring doorbell on a 1770s house.
So that was something that struck us as very odd from the first press conference, that it had been hours and they said that they were still pulling surveillance footage. They were trying to get images. That was the first press conference. And we were sitting there at the desk thinking, you're trying to get images. It's been 3 hours. You don't have any images. If this person is at large and you can release that to the public and ask for help, you'd think that you could get on it a little quicker. Again, I don't know all the circumstances there, but that struck us as a little weird. And then looking at Brown and how many cameras they have, it's one of the most, I guess, surveillance heavy institutions in America as far as universities go, and they have that one camera. I know maybe not in a classroom you don't have cameras, but hallways you don't have cameras, back doors you don't have cameras, sidewalks you don't have cameras. That seems a little odd to me. And again, I don't know. I'm just looking at it from someone who covered it for 7 hours this weekend.
Right.
It was a little weird.
It is different. So let's say that building's old. Let's say you buy into all that. They didn't have cameras in there. You should have them leaving the campus.
Yeah.
You should be able to see that. And let's say you could geolocate people, but not if you don't have a phone. So maybe this guy was smart enough not to have a phone, so you wouldn't be able to track him or anything like that. So maybe that be one thing. But maybe he does have a phone. You'd be just like it looked impossible to ever get those pipe bombers in front of the RNC and DNC. And they said, wait a second, we're able to geolocate his phone and be able to find out that he lived right in the area. And we know this guy, his name is Brian Cole. So we'll see what happens with that. But do you have any other suspicions about the theme behind this hitting Brown University?
I don't know Brown specifically, but I know I wish we had more answers about the class itself. Who was teaching the class? Again, social media is the one that's reporting a lot of this. And it's unfortunate because a lot of social media is BS. But when you don't give the people a lot of information, when you have the Brown University president not being able to answer basic questions about that class, then you leave people online to fill in the blanks for you. And unfortunately, a lot of that is baloney. But when you look at who was supposedly teaching the class that wasn't there that day, when you look at the students in the class, you look at the first day of Hanukkah. Again, we don't know any of those things. But if you add all those things together, you look at patterns. And we look at our soldiers being attacked in Syria. We look at Australia and the Hanukkah attack there, an anti-Semitic attack, obviously. So you got to look at those things and you got to you know, build patterns where you can. And again, we don't have the information. So can you fault a sophisticated audience for not putting things together and asking more questions? I think we have every right to do that at this point.
49 millimeter shots fired, two loaded 30 round magazines recovered. But the other thing is, did you see the eyewitness on ABC where he said he had a big gun, the biggest gun he's seen? I go, okay, big for a handgun, because we heard it was a handgun. Yeah. But this one guy is says it was a large gun. It was a long gun, rather.
Yeah, that doesn't
fit. Rifle? And then if you're watching that guy, did he look like he had a rifle in his side of his pants? No.
No.
So where is that weapon?
Yeah. And again, I don't know if maybe the student's just not familiar with firearms. So that looked big to him. I don't know. Maybe it had some kind of an attachment to make it look bigger. That could have been it. But also, this information about he shouted something. Nobody knows what he shouted. Nobody knows what language he shouted it in. That's weird to me that of all the people there that witnessed it, that they couldn't give us any indication about what he shouted. Was it, I hate this class, or was it something in a different language? You'd think even if it was somewhat unintelligible, you could figure out bits and pieces. That's weird to me.
I know. It just seems to be the holidays seem to be a red hot area. Now, I remember what happened on New Year's Day, and then we see the first day of Hanukkah, and you wonder what else the holidays mean to someone like that. So the one thing I'm heartened by when it comes to Australia, that guy, the Syrian who sells fruit, and saw all the Hanukkah parishioners who are going down to that spot that they had in Bondi Beach, he ends up spotting the gunman and lining him up on his side and kind of tackling the guy and taking that gun away. We never see stuff like that, especially for non-military people.
Right.
So anyone who says all Muslims are bad or they're all want to hate, you're not paying attention. That guy's from Syria, a Muslim, Ahmed. And he was able to do that.
Right. Well, it takes a lot to do that. It takes a lot of guts. Again, I have a lot of questions there, too, about why. And we don't know the mindset. If you're going to take someone down, obviously, it's a high intensity situation. It's chaotic. But he either didn't know how to operate that gun or he didn't want to kill the terrorist.
Why wouldn't you shoot him?
Yeah. And then he ended up going and finding his, you know, I guess his father or the son. I'm not sure which one. And then they ended up shooting him. So he
got shot twice.
Yeah, he did a heroic thing, no doubt. But I think it also goes back to, I'm hearing some people in Australia say, we just need more gun laws. It's like,
out of everything, that should take away.
And then the police, again, I don't like to criticize law enforcement, but we get several reports. We took a lot out of Sky News this weekend saying that the police didn't really know how to react, or that they were, you know, fear stunned and they couldn't react as quickly. It went on for a real long time. So again, when you have a culture that's terrified of guns, sometimes when someone has a gun, you don't know how to act in that situation. I don't think it's helpful.
So let's take I want to get your take on Venezuela. It looks like we've named eight other tankers that we say are these ghost tankers that we're going to start targeting to pull them over. And that tanker that we took, the skipper, was heading with $80 million worth of oil for Cuba. So that's now denied. I'm not sure Cuba has how much they have built into a rainy day fund. Yeah. But my sense is not a lot. So your sense of where Trump's going with this, and where do you hope he's going with this?
Well, again, I don't think anybody wants to see a war, not in the Middle East, not in Venezuela. I don't want to see that. But I think that his estimation is, for too long this has been happening. I'm not going to let traffickers come across the border. I'm not going to allow criminals that are in this country to remain in this country who are illegal aliens. And I'm going to stop this, the drugs and whatever else, and the money that goes to fund the drug cartels. I'm going to stop it before it enters here. And for a lot of people like myself that are very America first, I support that, because I'd rather take it out there than take it out here.
So I want you to hear what Maria Corina Machado said from Norway. You know, she did win, her party did win the election, and she was basically exiled. They wouldn't let her take office. Cut 40.
We are facing not a conventional dictatorship. This is a very complex criminal structure that has turned Venezuela into the safe haven of international crime and terrorist activities, starting with Russia, Iran, Cuba, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Colombian guerrilla, the drug cartels operating freely and directed in partnership with Maduro and his regime. And as every criminal structure suffers is when the inflows from their criminal activities are cut. Mm-hmm. And this, in the case of the Maduro regime, comes from the oil black market, the drug trafficking, gold smuggling, arms smuggling, even human smuggling.
So this is going to be could be a complex operation with all those entities into Venezuela to squeeze them out.
Right. And the people of Venezuela, I'm thinking about how many Major League Baseball players we have. They're in Venezuela right now. They better get out soon. I think that, now would be a good time. Now would be a good time to get back here.
Today, Congress is going to get, the House is going to get briefed from Pete and Marco Rubio. My sense is, no matter what Kristi Noem or Pete Hegseth say, every Democrat's going to go. They got to go. Right. There's they just cannot take anything that Pete or Kristi Noem says.
Yeah.
Your reaction to that?
Well, I'm not
surprised. I don't think either one of them are in danger of losing their jobs.
No, I don't think so either. And I think that, you know, when they're sitting there telling Kristi Noem to resign and she's saying, I take that as a compliment that I'm doing my job, I think that's exactly the attitude to have. And I don't think they care much about these wailing, squealing voices that are still arguing for the Maryland man to be, you know, amongst us. I don't think they, you know, put a lot of credit in that. I certainly don't.
The next is the double tap hit on the drug boat. That they want. Yeah. We got to see that video. That's the latest thing. We have to get the Epstein files. How's that going?
Yeah.
We got some pictures. They're not going too well for Democrats, certainly not for Larry Summers and Bill Gates. So more pictures are emerging with him and Prince Andrew. Where do you think that's going?
Yeah, I think they tried to make it a thing and then they realized that it backfired a little bit because we know that they never cared about it for how many years. They had this information. They never cared about it ever. And then they thought we can get Trump. And then they failed again. So at some point, maybe they'll catch on that all these get Trump missions ain't working.
Tom Massie, where was the sincerity in trying to get the Epstein files for years?
Yeah.
The Republican in Maryland. Listen, you're going to do outnumbered, right?
I am.
Are you going to give it your all?
I'm going to give it my all and then some.
That's going to be 7 hours in 3 days.
Actually, more.
More.
Because we did 4 hours on Saturday, 3 hours yesterday. So this will be my eighth hour.
You don't even need notes. It's all up there,
right?
We got
it all here.
You got it all. All right. We'll look forward to seeing you on Outnumber at the top of the hour. Back in a moment with more to know. Do us in the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade. More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
Last week, President Trump hosted multiple events at the Kennedy Center, including an award ceremony for Sylvester Stallone, Gloria Gaynor, and rock band Kiss, as well as a musical performance by the Village People, which raises the question, is Donald Trump a gay man from 1978?
And that was obviously SNL over the weekend. Once in a while, they're all hits on Trump. I just wish they do a little hits on other people, but I'm not going to script for Lorne Michaels. Let's find out if there's even more to know. Rob Reiner and Michelle Reiner's son, Nick, has been arrested on charges of murder and his parents' stabbing deaths. He's 32 years old. He's being held at Parker Center Jail in downtown Los Angeles. Rob's reps did not immediately respond to Page's Six. News broke of the couple's death on Sunday, with Nick identified as a person of interest, which explains why people say after a double murder next door, they say there's nothing to worry about.
Yeah, there wasn't some.
I'm still mystified by all this. But next. Santa's cookies now cost $8.44. As egg prices drive holiday inflation, cookie costs are up $2 compared to 2020. Butter, $2.99, is the most expensive ingredient for the batch, while milk was the only item rising slower than overall inflation at 1.7%, leaving cookies and milk for Santa now cost $8.44. Allison, will that stop you from leaving cookies? Could you leave a note? Santa, sorry, just too expensive.
No, we'll have to cut back elsewhere because Santa needs his cookies because he has to deliver the presents.
I don't get it. I thought egg prices were coming down. They drove most of the increase, jumping 136% since 2020. I thought the heavy, I don't know.
Well, if it's in 2020, then yes. But since like 2024, maybe they're down from 20, you know, last year. But if it's since 5 year span.
All right. You know. We'll look into it. Try to raise wages if you can. Next, Joe Biden has only raised a small fraction of what he needs to build his presidential library. Shocker. His library foundation expects to raise $11.3 million by 2027. Its $200 million goal for the project probably won't get realized. I wonder why. It would just be an empty hulk of a warehouse. Biden's foundation told the IRS this year that it expected to raise $11.3 million total by the end of 2027. That would be far below what he needs. Though it's not technically a presidential library, for contrast, Former President Obama's presidential center in Chicago raised $1.5 billion. Meanwhile, it's still not even built yet. It's in a monstrosity. The neighborhood hates it. It's not even open. President Trump announced that he's setting out to raise about $950 million before he leaves office. The outlet alleged that due to poor fundraising, there are discussions underway about consolidating a future library with pre-existing Biden institutions. Really? This is so sad.
But it's not surprising at all. When he left office, did you think that he was really... Who would want to be going to some grand Biden library?
Listen, I hear you. Next, Patrick Mahomes' season is over after a devastating knee injury took him out of Sunday's game, with the team just announcing he's torn his ACL. They lost 16-13 to the Chargers. A couple trainers helped Mahomes off the field for evaluation. They eventually walked him to the locker room. The two-time NFL MVP not making the playoffs. Could be it for Jason Kelce, for Travis Kelce. So he's been terrible this year. And the Chiefs are on the back cover of the New York Post because the Giants don't have, and the Jets aren't looked at as professional football teams anymore.
Well, that's sad. But what are we going to do when we don't see Taylor Swift up there with Kelce's daughter?
This is the first tragedy. This is the first hardship of this relationship. Can they survive a relationship when one of them doesn't make the playoffs?
That's a good question. And if he, retires, he'll be unemployed.
So now this weekend, they're going to go, I don't know, what are you doing? I don't know, what do you want to do? Because they now have free weekends. Although I bet you Kelce ends up on the desk somewhere.
Probably.
Yeah, helping out Fox or NBC. Is that it? We don't have any more time? Well, you know how I love panda stories.
You love pandas so much.
And now people are going to wonder, what do we mean by panda story?
We're taking away pandas for you before Christmas. That's not right.
Well, I understand. But at least we got away from the murder for a little while, and we just talked about things that were also in the news, except for, of course, the first story, which was about a murder. Brian Kilmeade Show.